And the big development today is that a hospital was bombed in Gaza, killing over 500 people. And it looks as though Israel is responsible. In fact, no other country really could be responsible, given some of the video evidence of the strike. And we'll get into that. But Palestine has blamed Israel. Israel has blamed Palestine, although it seems that that's just a reflexive move. The whole world attributes the attack to Israel. And so I'll read this. This is a news story from the New York Times about the attack. It says, quote, an explosion killed hundreds of people on Tuesday at a hospital in Gaza City that was packed with people sheltering there, as Palestinians and Israelis blamed each other for a tragedy that inflamed the region, just as President Biden was expected to arrive in Israel. Hamas, the group that controls Gaza, said an Israeli airstrike had caused the blast at the Ali Arab Hospital. Hours later, Israeli officials said that one of the rockets fired at Israel by Palestine had failed shortly after launch, causing what could be the deadliest single incident of the 10-day war. The Israeli military and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Tuesday that the blast at the hospital resulted from a failed rocket launch by Islamic Jihad, a group allied with Hamas. Islamic Jihad denied the allegation. A spokeswoman for the Gazan Health Ministry put the toll at 500 or more dead, although the ministry later changed that to hundreds. No figure could be confirmed independently, but images from the hospital, which is run by the Anglican Church, and witness accounts made clear that it was very high. Israeli planes have been pummeling Gaza in retaliation for Hamas's October 7th massacre and kidnapping of Israelis. The bombing campaign and Israel's directive to evacuate North Gaza, including Gaza City, have displaced hundreds of thousands of people, killed or wounded thousands, and left people throughout the territory perilously low on water, food, fuel, and medicine. People who fled their homes were sleeping in the streets. Fights were breaking out over food. Hospitals were increasingly unable to care for a flood of wounded patients. More than a week of international talks have yielded no agreement to allow vital supplies into the territory, to let some people exit, or to create safe zones for civilians within Gaza, where more than 2 million people are trapped in worsening conditions. So that paints a picture of what's going on. In case you've not been watching, this is the situation. Palestine is home to 2.1 million people. They have been blockaded by Israel for 10 days, meaning no food, no water, no fuel, or medicine has gone in at all. The Gaza Strip, there's only three checkpoints in and out, and two of them are controlled by Israel, which have been closed, and one, the Rafah crossing, is controlled by Egypt, but that has been continuously bombed by Israel. So it's 2.1 million people trapped in this territory. All the checkpoints are closed. People can't enter. People can't leave. Most of the electricity and water and food comes through the Israeli checkpoints, and Israel's not permitting any of that to go in. So no food, water, medicine, fuel has gone into Gaza in over a week. At the same time, this would already be bad. At the same time, on Thursday, Israel ordered the 1.1 million residents of North Gaza to evacuate. 1.1 million people. It's a very tiny territory, and they've ordered 1.1 million in the northern half to flee. Where they're going to flee, nobody knows, because it's totally blockaded and no one's allowed to leave. So 1.1 million in the midst of this blockade, in the midst of everything that's going on, they're being forced to walk or ride donkeys or on the hoods of cars south in an already densely populated area. So they're pushing all 2 million people in just the southern half. At the same time that this is going on, they're dropping bombs on them. They're bombing the people evacuating. They're bombing schools, mosques, hospitals, ambulances. And the latest today is that they bombed a hospital where the wounded and other displaced people were camping out. So not only were they treating the sick and the wounded, but also refugees were being housed there. So this is the situation. This is just like probably the worst place on earth. And as I've been stressing for the last week, this is collective punishment. These people, this is all deliberate. This is all intentional by Israel. 3,000 Hamas militants invaded Israel. They killed 1,600 people, and it was a horrible tragedy. And there should be a response from Israel. But what Israel has undertaken is vengeance. They took that terrorist attack and they have used it as an excuse to put Gaza under siege. And not just the military. We're not talking about they let civilians leave so they could attack the military or something. They have trapped all the people of Gaza in this place. They have made 500,000 of them homeless, which is a quarter of the entire population. And they'll have no home to return to because they've bombed all the infrastructure where they fled from. And the people that are attempting to leave, they're killing them indiscriminately from the air. And then the people that are being put up in hospitals for treatment or for shelter, they're now killing them. And so, like I said, the latest report today is that this hospital was bombed and 500 died. And both sides blame each other. There's this curious problem where Gaza's been bombed for 10 days. A hospital gets bombed. And the Israelis said, oh, they did it. You know, the Palestinians did it. And it's incredible because there has been wall-to-wall shilling on social media and in the news that perhaps Palestine was in fact responsible. It's incredible. Understand that Israel has been bombing Palestine every day for over a week in retaliation. They've been bombing hospitals. They've been bombing schools and bombing mosques. And they've said alternatively, on the one hand, they say, well, if we bomb a school, that's because Hamas was using the school as a human shield. So we can do that. You know, so on the one hand, they try to justify attacking civilian infrastructure by saying that in reality, it's military infrastructure disguised as civilian infrastructure. So if they kill civilians, if they blow up a school, well, it was the fault of Hamas for putting their base there. On the one hand, they'll say that. On the other hand, the president of Israel has said that every Palestinian in Gaza is responsible, and so they'll all be punished for it. And Israeli legislators have said that the Palestinians are human animals. They deserve to be killed. So which is it? You know, but either way, they've been bombing civilian infrastructure and civilians. They've been killing innocent people all week. And on the one hand, they say, well, we have to do that because those people are in the way of Hamas. So it's really, even though no one likes killing civilians, it's really the fault of Hamas because they put them in harm's way. On the other hand, they're saying we don't care. We're going to kill civilians because they're animals and they're all responsible. They might as well all be Hamas. So either way, they're bombing civilians. And they, on the one hand, they'll make an excuse. On the other hand, they say, you know what? We just want to kill them all. Today, a hospital is bombed. It's the deadliest incident in the war. And Israel says, oh, well, you know, we've been bombing hospitals all week. And, you know, sometimes we make excuses. Sometimes we just own it and say we're murdering them. But it wasn't us today. Today, it was their own side. Their own side accidentally blew up their own hospital. We bombed 70 schools, which is a real number, by the way. They've bombed 70 schools. And we bombed ambulances, you know, but this one we didn't do. This time it was them, and they did it on accident. But there's just one problem. We have video of the strike. And if you pay attention to the video, it sounds as though whatever type of munition was used entered Mach 1, which produces a certain sound, which sounds exactly like American-supplied JDAM missiles. And if you listen to a video comparison, which is all over Twitter, they sound exactly the same. So the missile that hit the hospital sounds just like all the other American missiles that are hitting all the other hospitals that Israel is sending. What a coincidence. Additionally, All the Palestinian rockets that have been launched do not destroy entire buildings. If you look at any of the damage on the Israeli side or any of the missiles that Hamas has used in the past, these are not serious munitions. They don't have that kind of velocity, and they don't have that kind of ordnance. They're not blowing up entire buildings. No Palestinian rocket launched by Hamas has ever destroyed a building. It just hasn't happened. They'll do damage, but they don't level a building like this. That's advanced, sophisticated rocketry that Israel is responsible for. And then the Israelis go out and they say, well, it was a munitions depot, that it was ammunition that Palestine was storing there and it all exploded. And that's how we can account for the fact that the Palestinian rockets don't have that kind of explosive power. The problem with this is that if it was ammunition, it would take minutes to explode. If it was ammunition that was blowing up like a fireworks factory, it would take minutes to unfold. The strike on the hospital was over in 1 second. So it was obviously a missile, just based on the evidence that we've seen, the video, the level of destruction, how the explosion was detonated. It's clear. And based on all the evidence that it's been a week of Israel bombing hospitals, it was obviously Israel. And so the response from the Arab world is outrage. And by the way, the significance of this, like I said yesterday and last week, is that the more severe and brutal Israel's war against Gaza becomes, this will anger Muslims across the entire Muslim world. Right now, there is this factional dispute in the Middle East between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And so Iran backs Syria and Hezbollah, and it backs Shiite militias in Iraq, and it backs Houthi rebels in Yemen, and Saudi Arabia supports the Iraqi government, and Saudi Arabia supports the rebels in Syria, and Saudi Arabia supports the government in Yemen, and so on and so forth. The point is, there's a lot of disagreement in the Muslim world. And that is a staging ground for a wider proxy conflict between the United States and China. Iran and Syria are allies of Russia and China, and Saudi Arabia and Israel are allies of the United States. But as I said yesterday and Friday, the more severe and brutal Israel is in their war in Gaza, this will rally Muslims everywhere. It doesn't matter that Egypt signed the Camp David Accords. It doesn't matter that Jordan's at peace with Israel. It doesn't matter that 2 weeks ago, Saudi Arabia was ready to normalize ties with Israel. No Muslims like to see Israel slaughtering Palestinian civilians. And so, and I said, Muslims across the entire region are going to be outraged. And in countries that are friendly, it's going to turn them against Israel. And in countries that are already against Israel, it's going to force these militias to attack Israel and widen the conflict. So I'll elaborate on that further in a moment. But this is an article from New York Times about the response to this bombing of the hospital. It says, quote, "The catastrophe drew heated reactions from Egypt and Jordan, which are two Arab governments that made peace with Israel decades ago, as well as from others with whom Israel's relations were just starting to warm, including Saudi Arabia. King Abdullah II of Jordan called the explosion a heinous crime that cannot be ignored and declared a 3-day mourning period in his country for those killed. President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority said he was returning from Jordan to the West Bank on Tuesday, and Jordan had canceled a planned meeting of regional leaders at which U.S. President Biden had been set to meet with Mr. Abbas. Mr. Biden is now skipping the stop in Jordan. The Saudi government said in a statement on Tuesday night that Israel was responsible for the death at the hospital and a, quote, flagrant violation of all international laws and norms, which is an accusation repeated by many Arab governments. Among them was Egypt, which issued a statement demanding that Israel immediately cease its collective punishment policies against the people of the Gaza Strip." And so this is a very precarious situation now. prior to the war breaking out, as we've talked about over the past couple of weeks, there was a changing paradigm in the Middle East. And if you haven't been following the show, if you don't know all the background, at the end of the day, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is about integrating the Israeli state into the Middle East. In 1948, Israel declares independence, and they force all of the Palestinians that live in Israel out of the country as refugees. And they go into the Gaza Strip, they go into the West Bank, into Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, as refugees. And they call this the Nakba, or the catastrophe. This is like the original sin of Israel, is to declare their independence, force everybody out. And ever since then, all the Muslim countries have hated Israel. And four times, from 1948 to 1973, a coalition of Arab Muslim countries have gone to war with Israel to wipe it off the map. In 1948, when they declared independence, in 1956, during the Suez Canal crisis, in 1967, during the Six-Day War, and in 1973, during the Yom Kippur War. All four wars, Israel won. And Israel gradually got stronger in every single war. In 1948, the United Nations came in and forced a ceasefire on both sides. And in the meantime, Israel armed itself and was able to drive the Arabs out. After 1967, Israel acquired a nuclear arsenal. After 1973, Israel basically got full-fledged security guarantee from the United States. And it gets to the point in the 1970s where the Arabs realize they're never going to defeat Israel militarily. They can't win. And so in 1978, Israel makes a peace deal with Egypt, which was huge because Egypt was the most powerful country that was leading the charge against Israel in all those wars. So in 1978, first Muslim country, aside from Turkey, Egypt normalizes its relationship with Israel and makes peace with them and establishes a diplomatic relation. 20 years later, in 1994, Israel makes peace with its other neighbor, Jordan, across the Jordan River. Under Donald Trump, Israel began to make peace with other Arab countries under the Abraham Accords framework. And so they normalized ties with the United Arab Emirates, with Bahrain, which are two Gulf countries, with Morocco, and began the process with Sudan. Under Biden last week, Israel was about to normalize ties with Saudi Arabia. And this was key because what was being created here was a Middle East where Israel was effectively integrated. There was a scenario just 2 weeks ago where Israel would establish a normal diplomatic relationship with virtually all of its Muslim neighbors without resolving the Palestinian dispute. And so this would thread the needle where Israel could have a normal relationship with all these countries without necessarily having to solve the Palestinian issue, which is intractable and has been the impasse, which has prevented Israel from integrating into the region. That was really the brilliance of the Abraham Accords, is it sidestepped an impossible conflict and said that the Muslim world would accept Israel without necessarily having to accept Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. And what this would do is at the same time create a bifurcation in the Middle East where you had a coalition backed by the United States, which would consist of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries, Jordan, and Israel. And naturally, they would be set against Iran, Syria, and their patrons, China and Russia. And so we would have a Middle East that was split of countries that recognize Israel and are allied with the United States, and countries that remain hostile towards Israel and are allied with China and Russia. But this has been a 50-year process. It started with the Camp David Accords. That was Egypt. It was Jordan in 94. And this new framework, the Abraham Accords, which brings in Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, was just in the past few years. And it was about to be finished under Biden. And this would, again, bifurcate the Middle East and draw a new sort of Cold War line between America's allies recognizing Israel and the continued adversaries of Israel backed by the others. What the bombing of the hospital does is twofold. One, it unites all the Muslims against Israel. And so, although we had been working on this deal to have Saudi Arabia recognize Israel, at the same time, China has been brokering a new diplomatic relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They've been in a Cold War for 45 years, ever since the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979. Saudi Arabia and Iran have been fighting each other, and in the last 10 years, this has consumed the entire Middle East. They've been fighting each other in virtually every country. And at the same time, the Biden was working out a deal to bring Saudi Arabia into the orbit of the United States and to normalize ties with Israel. At the same time, there was this warming of ties between old Muslim adversaries who couldn't have been more at odds, Iran and Saudi Arabia. And so one thing that the bombing of the hospital does is it drives adversaries like Saudi Arabia and Iran together. And it brings pretty much the whole Muslim world. Countries that have been friendly to Israel, like Egypt and Jordan, are condemning them. Turkey is condemning Israel. And it's creating a scenario, it looks increasingly likely, where perhaps Turkey, Egypt, Iran, and Saudi Arabia may all be on the same side against Israel, which has never happened ever. There's never been that level of Muslim unity since, like, the fall of the Ottoman Empire. It's never happened before. So one, it unites the entire Muslim world together. And this Cold War that's going on, where the United States and Israel have allies, all that goodwill, all that diplomacy that has taken decades to build up, it is disappearing every time Israel does something like this. So that's number one. Number two, of course, on the flip side of that, not only is the Muslim world united together against Israel, but they're also united against the United States. Because, as we've discussed, the United States has deployed two aircraft carriers in the Eastern Mediterranean to make it so that Iran cannot pressure Israel with the threat of an attack. Because perhaps Israel may not be so brutal and severe in their retaliation against Hamas if there was a reasonable fear that Iran may attack Israel. But if the United States is deployed in the region, then it checks Iran and it checks that pressure and it allows Israel to do whatever it wants. It lets Israel bomb hospitals. They don't need to be afraid of Iran because Iran is afraid of the United States, which is now in the neighborhood. So the Muslim world doesn't just hold Israel responsible, but they also hold the United States responsible. And so now not only can Saudi Arabia not normalize ties with Israel, and not only are they now friendly with Iran because they both have in common that they hate Israel, but also it makes it more likely that Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the Emirates, and Turkey fall into the sphere of influence of Russia and China. Because Russia and China support the two-state solution. Russia and China support Palestine being granted statehood, and they oppose the humanitarian disaster that's going on. So it's uniting all the Muslims together, which is unprecedented, and it's also uniting them against America and uniting them with our adversaries, Russia and China. And think about how that reshapes the geopolitical landscape, where by the end of this conflict, perhaps the United States is antagonistic towards Russia, China, and all the Muslim countries. This is where we are in 2023. All the blood shed by the United States, all the money spent, decades of soft and hard power of diplomacy, and at the end of it, we are at war with Russia and China and all Muslim countries in the world. Because no Muslim country is going to want to be allied with the United States if they're guaranteeing that Israel can kill Muslim civilians in hospitals. It just doesn't work like that. And I've been calling it, it's a diplomatic revolution. Diplomatic revolution means all the old alliances, all the old coalitions have radically changed. This is what's been happening since Russia, Ukraine, and Israel's attack on Gaza is doing that now because it's rallying all of them together. The other aspect of the attack on the hospital is this. We've also talked about the fact that the biggest risk in the Israel-Palestine conflict is that the conflict will widen and escalate. Right now, it's a local conflict, which is really not a big deal. Hamas is not a big deal. And although Israel invading Gaza will be very logistically difficult and very technically challenging, it's not actually a big deal. Hamas is not an existential threat to Israel. But of course, now that Israel is bombing civilians, Iran is threatening that they will get involved. Iran is threatening that they will mobilize the axis of resistance, which constitutes Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Assad regime in Syria, Shiite militias in Iraq, Houthi rebels in Yemen, and they will all be mobilized to attack Israel if Israel is too brutal in the attack on Gaza. So that's the conflict widening. The United States is now there with its two aircraft carriers and 2,000 Marines to deter Iran from attacking Israel. And that should, in all things being equal in a vacuum, that should make it so that Iran cannot attack Israel. You know, and it's like a game of chess. Iran puts Israel in check, so Israel can't kill Palestinians, because Iran might attack Israel with all its hundreds of thousands of militias across the region. But the United States being there puts Iran in check, because Iran can't attack Israel if the United States has 100 planes on two aircraft carriers right off the coast. The problem is that perhaps Iran and Hezbollah cannot help their fighters attacking Israel. And perhaps other countries can't either. And what I mean by that is, if Israel is blowing up hospitals and killing hundreds of wounded civilians, you can clearly imagine a scenario where Hezbollah will attack Israel in spite of the American presence in the region. If Iran is saying that they will intervene if Israel inflicts too many civilian casualties, you could see a scenario where these Iranian militias get tired of waiting, where they have to intervene despite America being there and retaliating. So maybe Hezbollah is not even able to restrain its own fighters. Maybe Iran is not even able to restrain itself because the people in Iran are revolting. And that's part of the backlash against the hospital being blown up, is that there have been massive demonstrations outside of an American military base in Turkey, outside the American embassy in Beirut, outside the American embassy in Jordan. And so if the people in all these countries are revolting, if they're rioting, if they're blowing up embassies because Israel is so brutal in its attack on Gaza, then maybe Iran can't control its own people and they attack Israel in spite of the guaranteed retaliation by the United States. And that gets to my question, which I asked at the beginning of the show. If we want to assess who is responsible for the bombing of the hospital, outside of the hard evidence, we have to ask who benefits. And the question of who benefits is tied up in what is the end game of all the players involved. And just like we talked about 10 days ago, the fact that Hamas attack on Israel curiously benefits Israel, an attack on Israel by Hezbollah also benefits Israel. Because what is Israel's end game? We don't even have to speculate. They tell us all the time, and they've told us for decades. In the 1980s, under Israeli Prime Minister Oded Yonan, they drafted a grand strategy for their country. And since the 1980s, it has been the Jewish maximalists, it's been the very aggressive Likud politicians that have been in charge, basically uninterrupted for 40 years, with some exceptions. Point is, they've had this plan in place. It's the same people have been running this country that drafted this plan. And the grand strategy for the Middle East that was authored in the 1980s said this. It said that their goal, in order that Israel should never be challenged by a strong Arab state or a coalition of Arab states, their goal is to destroy all of the powerful Arab countries. And the word that they use, or the phrase that they use, is they want to destroy the Arab states such that the Middle East becomes a mosaic of tribes with flags. That's the phrase they use, a mosaic of tribes with flags. And so the idea is that in 48, 56, 67, and 73, Israel was threatened by strong Arab nationalist or Islamist countries, powerful governments with big militaries that formed coalitions and attacked Israel. So Israel said, after they had finally defeated them in 73, they said, well, then there can be no powerful Arab states. There can be no powerful Muslim states. We will destroy all the big states, and what will remain in its place are these little fiefdoms, these little tribes with flags. These guys that don't really have big militaries, they don't command a large territory. The Middle East will be a mosaic. Rather than large territories governed by powerful states with big militaries, it'll be a mosaic of tiny little tribes. And then none of them can gather together and oppose Israel. None of them could concentrate enough power or organize to fight Israel on a collective basis. Tribes with flags. In 1996, they published the Clean Break memo on behalf of the Israeli government, which was written by a lot of the neocons in the Bush administration. And they said specifically they have a problem on their northern border. On their southern border, they have Egypt, which they have peace with. On their eastern border, they have Jordan, which they made peace with in 1994. But on their northern border, in southern Lebanon, is Hezbollah, which is a very powerful Shiite militia, which is funded by Iran. And Hezbollah is supplied by supply lines that go through Syria, which is controlled by Assad, an ally of Iran. And it goes into Iran, which is the mortal enemy of Israel. And Iraq is allied with Syria, and Iraq also poses a problem. So Israel said, in order to secure our northern border, this is in the Clean Break paper in 96, they said we have to topple Saddam Hussein, we have to degrade Syria, and we have to have regime change in Iran. Only then can they disrupt this supply line into Hezbollah. Only then can Israel truly be safe from its powerful neighboring adversaries. And that's exactly what's happened. Libya was taken out. Iraq was taken out by the United States. We tried to take out Assad, although the United States and Israel were unsuccessful. Russia intervened and saved Assad. But nevertheless, Assad has been greatly diminished by the civil war that has been going on for over 10 years. And the crown jewel, what they've wanted all this time, is to topple Iran. That's why every year they go to the United Nations General Assembly. That's why they publish these videos constantly, and they hysterically talk about how Iran is 1 year away from a nuclear bomb. They've been saying it for 20 years. That's why they had Trump tear up the Iran nuclear deal. That's why Israel assassinates Iranian scientists and attacks their centrifuges. The crown jewel that Israel wants is to destroy Iran, because they see destroying Iran as essential to their peace and safety in the region. They don't want Iran to develop a nuclear arsenal. They don't like Iran having a powerful conventional military. They don't like Iran supplying Hezbollah through Syria. And so the motivation truly of this Likud regime and Netanyahu and of Israel is to destroy Iran. So once again, the question is, what is the end game of the parties involved? Israel's end game, contrary to what might seem intuitive, it is not to destroy Hamas. In fact, they like Hamas. 10 days ago, Hamas invaded Israel, and it gave Israel a crisis that they could utilize to ethnically cleanse the Gaza Strip. And that's what they're doing. Hamas attacked Israel, and Israel is using this atrocity to rally the United States and to suppress its opponents so that they could go in, defeat Hamas, and probably annex or ethnically cleanse the Gaza Strip, which is what they want. At the same time, what they've wanted for decades is to destroy Iran. Now, if they bomb the hospital in Palestine, it incites Muslims across the world. From Turkey to Indonesia, Muslims are outraged by this. They're burning the embassy. They're protesting outside the military base. And it just might force the hand of Hezbollah or Iran to attack Israel. If people in Jordan are burning down the embassy, Hezbollah has just, they want to attack Israel for this. So let's say Hezbollah attacks Israel. Israel, just like when Hamas attacked Israel last week, if Hezbollah attacks Israel today or tomorrow, now Israel has an excuse, just like then. Israel has a pretext not just to strike Hezbollah, but also Iran, which is supplying them, and Syria, which is the territory through which Iran is supplying them. And if Israel attacks Iran and attacks Syria, then that draws the United States into a war between Israel and Iran. It forces the United States potentially into a regime change war against Iran. Israel attacking Hezbollah, attacking Iran, and then Iran retaliating means that now the United States is dragged into a war with Iran. And there's really no way that this can end for the United States other than that Iran, or the regime that controls Iran, is removed from power. That's why I asked the question, what's their end game? Because that tells us what they want and allows us to answer the question, who benefits? Who benefits from Israel blowing up the hospital? Israel. Because Israel blowing up the hospital pisses off the Muslims. It forces the Muslims to attack Israel, and it allows Israel to attack Iran, which creates an interstate conflict that the United States has to intervene in and can end in no other way other than regime change in Iran. That's what they want. And Netanyahu, as we talked about last week, 50%+ of Israelis say that he should step down when this crisis is over. So it's in his interest for this crisis to go on as long as possible. More than 80% of Israelis blame him for the initial attack from Hamas. What's more, Netanyahu is under investigation by the justice system for corruption. So if this crisis ends, and if Netanyahu is then forced out of power, he will go to jail. So it's not just in the Likud party or Israel's interest to topple Iran. It's also in Netanyahu's interest, who's the prime minister, for this crisis to be as long and drawn out and wide and intense as possible, because all that does for him is defer his removal from power and imprisonment. And that's what we're looking at. And let's entertain a scenario where the United States is at war with Iran. Let's say, because it's looking increasingly likely, if you've been paying attention, the Iranian foreign minister just went on a tour. He went to Lebanon and met with Hezbollah. He went to Damascus and met with Assad. He went to Iraq and met with the militias there. And what the Iranian foreign minister has said is that if there are too many civilian casualties, Iran will attack Israel through its proxies. So what does Israel do? They blow up a hospital. So let's say Hezbollah goes in, Israel attacks Iran, Iran attacks Israel. Now the United States is involved. And I want you to think about the global chessboard here. If Israel is attacked, the United States has to intervene to save Israel. Israel has a security guarantee as good as Germany or France or Italy or any of these other countries. They've basically got it. So the United States has to go to war with Iran. What happens next? Well, Iran is just like Syria, is allied with Russia and China. When the United States and Saudi Arabia and Israel backed rebels against the Assad regime in a proxy war, in an attempt to overthrow the Assad regime, Russia intervened. They did airstrikes against ISIS. They did airstrikes against the rebels. They supplied Assad with anti-aircraft guns and all the munitions they needed, and they saved Assad. And they made it a strategic failure for the United States, because the United States pursued the removal of Assad for 6 years before they abandoned it when it was clear that Assad wasn't going anywhere. If the United States goes to war with Iran, it's probable that Russia and China will do the same thing. And Iran is more powerful than Syria. Iran has a nuclear program, which means it has radioactive nuclear materials. And there is a mirror opposite situation happening in Ukraine, where Russia invaded Ukraine to denazify the government and to force regime change in Kiev. And the United States didn't declare war on Russia, but we sent Ukraine all our missiles. We sent all of our anti-aircraft, our tanks, our artillery, logistical support, everything short of intervening directly. Now, this is a make or break war for Russia. If Russia loses in Ukraine, it's over for them. They have to secure some kind of victory and they can't back off. The same will be true in Iran. The United States will have to have a victory against the Iranian regime. And it will put Russia and China in the opposite position that we are in right now, where the United States, it may seem simple, but Iran is going into a mountainous country with difficult terrain and a massive army. And they've been armed with drones and with all the latest Russian equipment. They've got a peaceful, but they've got a nuclear program, which means the possibility of dirty bombs. And if the United States goes into this very complicated and challenging war, it's conceivable that Russia and China will be supplying Iran while we're there, and supplying them with types of weapons that will make it a very costly and bloody and difficult war. And when you consider the fact that in terms of manufacturing, we are at a major disadvantage. Russia and China together produce far more artillery shells, bullets, tanks than the United States can make and will be able to make in at least a decade. We will be funding Ukraine and supplying Ukraine. We will be funding Taiwan and supplying Taiwan. At the same time, we'd be at war with Iran directly on behalf of Israel, while China and Russia are funneling weapons to them as a lifeline. Now, what's different about Iran versus Ukraine is that the United States would be stupid and arrogant and bold enough to say that if Russia and China supply Iran, then we would go and attack Russia and China. It's not an unrealistic scenario that the United States would wind up in a direct confrontation with Russia and China over this. Because let's say, just like Israel attacks the airport in Aleppo because they fear that Iran is supplying Hezbollah through Syria, so they say, we'll attack the supply lines, and that's a legitimate target. It's not inconceivable that the United States would attack a Russian or Chinese convoy to supply Iran. Then we're in a shooting war with Russia and China and Iran and the entire Muslim world. And that when people talk about a credible threat of World War III, this is what we're talking about. And the tripwire comes down to this militia. It's not even a government. The tripwire is this militia, Hezbollah in South Lebanon, which is dead set on destroying Israel. They got 100,000 missiles, 100,000 guys. They're run by Iran, which is saying if Israel kills civilians, we will sick them on you. And Israel blows up a hospital and kills 500 people. What do you think Israel's after here? What's the end game? It seems hard to argue that Israel is not trying to set off a tripwire that brings the United States into a global conflict in order to destroy Iran. That's what seems to be happening here to me. Why else would Israel do it? Like we said, when you look at the video, when you look at the level of destruction, and what's been going on for the past week, it's just ridiculous to suggest that anyone other than Israel is responsible. Israel's blown up enough hospitals. This is exactly what they do. They say that the Palestinians are animals. Oh, but today they all come out and say, oh, we didn't blow up that hospital. We didn't blow up that hospital. 100 mosques, 100 schools, 100 ambulances, a convoy of 100 people fleeing. Well, we'll take credit for those. But that hospital, that was the Palestinians. It doesn't even make any sense. And this is a precision munition. These JDAMs that some say were used here, this is a precision missile. So they didn't accidentally hit this hospital. And if they're going out and denying involvement, that means it wasn't an accident. They didn't say, oops, they denied. When really everybody knows they did it. And that would suggest that they did it deliberately. And they're going to ethnically cleanse Gaza. And they're going to knock out two birds with one stone, clear out Gaza, potentially clear out the West Bank, invite these Iranian militias onto the battlefield to give them an excuse to attack Iran, which forces Iran to retaliate, which then drags the United States kicking and screaming to defeat Iran, which finalizes their 40-year plan, their 40-year foreign policy to make the Middle East a mosaic of tribes and flags. The only one that remains is Iran. Just take a look at a map. Take a look at a map. You'll see it. Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, they've all been taken out. They've all either been neutralized or they've been taken out. And what remains is Iran. That's what they want more than anything. So this is a very this is a very bad situation, because again, the hospital being blown up is just the beginning. Israel's about to go in with tanks, artillery, planes, and their goal is not to stop in Gaza City. It's going to be a protracted, long counterinsurgency where there will be a lot of civilian casualties. And they'll always be able to say, we let everybody evacuate. And once everybody is forced south, then Israel's going to move south. And they're going to force the refugees all across the world. They're going to force the refugees into Egypt and America, presumably, everywhere else. And then the United States is going to become the lucky winner of a million Palestinians who blame us for ethnically cleansing them, because we put our aircraft carrier there to make sure that it happened. It's just amazing. It's just, you know. And by the way, all of this could be avoided if the United States stands up to Israel. Israel is the pariah. Israel is the instigator here. And you see, they have their proxies out here like Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin. They're intimating that if the United States doesn't support Israel, Israel will nuke all its enemies. And it's a nuclear blackmail. If that's the case, the United States should treat Israel like a rogue state. If Israel is telling the United States, support us in a world war and support our genocide or else we will nuke our opponents, then we should treat them like North Korea. We should treat Israel like Iran. We should treat Israel like one of these countries. And the United States should say, no, you're not nuking anybody. And no, you're not going to ethnically cleanse Palestine and alienate us from the whole Muslim world and drag us into war with Iran. But we can't. And we can't do that because how many American billionaires, how many critical security infrastructure and government officials and so on are tied up with Israel? If we said that to Israel, if we tried to stand up, how many of our American titans of industry, billionaires, Wall Street guys, how many people in the NSA, how many people that run big tech would form a fifth column against the United States within our own borders? Just take a look at how many American billionaires contributed to Bibi Netanyahu's re-election. It's like all the American billionaires. Groups like ADL that can bankrupt Twitter, they and everybody that's on their Rolodex and everybody that was with Epstein and the Mossad and all these Jewish federations all of a sudden turn against the United States. Now do you see the problem? Here's a better question. If there is a rogue state that is blackmailing the United States with nuclear weapons so that we go and fight their war at the risk of a world war with Russia and China, and we can't do anything about it because of the infiltration of Jewish Zionists in our society, then how can America truly be sovereign if we have that level of subversion by Jewish Zionists in our society? That's the operative question in all of this. If Israel is a rogue state, which is, that's what it is. When Israel is saying you have to fight our war at the risk of a nuclear apocalypse or else we'll nuke everybody anyway, you're a rogue state. That's what North Korea does. There's no, and that's, Ben Shapiro is going and saying that. Ben Shapiro, an American conservative, is going out there and saying, here's what's going to happen. The United States is going to give Israel everything it needs or else Israel will nuke its neighbors. That's the behavior of a rogue state. If that was North Korea, we would put them under a sanctions regime. We would pursue shadow regime change. We would force the hand of some other superpower to deal with them. Here's the problem when it's Israel. Israel has so many loyalists, not just in America, but in America's elite class. It would be catastrophic. The United States is prohibited from designating or treating Israel like a rogue state for that reason. How can we be sovereign with that arrangement? How can America be independent? Now, maybe if it was some other country that doesn't matter, like Togo or, I don't know, Equatorial Guinea, maybe it'd be different if there were a lot of them in our elites. But this is a country that is now at the center of potentially World War III, and we can't do shit about it because of how many of them there are running stuff over here. And no one would feel any differently if you mirrored it with China or Russia. If we couldn't effectively fight China because so many people in the elite were Chinese and waved a Chinese flag and organized in Chinese federations and said anyone who opposes the domination of the elite by China is Sinophobic, people would understand the problem there. If it was all Russians, people would understand the problem. If you tuned into CNN today or last year and their coverage of the Russian war was dominated by ethnically Russian newscasters saying, oh, Russia's the victim. Oh, poor Russia. And the United States couldn't go to war with Russia because, hey, everyone in Google and everyone in big tech and everyone in the Wall Street is ethnically Russian, pro-Russia. We would see the problem. But people have let it fly with Israel because they say, well, Israel's our closest ally. We would never have a problem with them. They're our closest ally. We're Judeo-Christian. They're just like us. They're the 51st state. America and Israel have an identical national interest. There'd never be a conflict. So it would never be a problem that so many Zionist Jews are in power in America. What happens when it is a problem? What happens when there is a divergence with world-altering consequences? We're finding out.